Oppenheimer in Japan. The Academy Award-winning film only opened in Japan in March 2024, more than a full year after its premiere in the rest of the world. Why the holdup? And how has the film been received? As the only country in the world to have had atomic bombs used against it in wartime, you'd think that Japan would be staunchly opposed to nuclear weapons and take the opportunity created by this film to raise anti-nuclear consciousness. But this is not the case. Why? It takes a genuine expert, a professor at the Hiroshima Peace Institute, to sort through the issues to get to the core. And when he tells you,
the national government is fairly pro-military, is enthusiastically under the American nuclear umbrella, and so talk of nuclear abolition, talk of the inhumanity of nuclear weapons, runs counter to official policy. So you're not finding the advocacy of any of these issues nationally. And so this, I'm sure, contributes to the fact that it's not really highlighted and promoted throughout the entire country the way that people here in Hiroshima feel like probably is happening and certainly is what we experience locally.
Well, when Professor Robert Beau Jacobs of the Hiroshima Peace Institute explains why even in Japan, in the wake of the Oppenheimer film, there is no massive movement against nuclear weapons, nor even a push to sign the United Nations Treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons, you get a glimpse of how entrenched the assumption of nuclear weapons and potential nuclear war has become, putting every one of us into that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Professor Robert Beau Jacobs of the Hiroshima Peace Institute and author of the book Nuclear Bodies, The Global Hibakusha. He takes us through the issues underlying the Japanese public's reluctance and resistance to pushing more forcefully against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. We focus on the recent premiere of the film Oppenheimer in that country and what it has done and not done to raise awareness. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, the ICAN update, news from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, direct from ICAN headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, and more honest nuclear information than has yet been revealed in the Stormy Daniels trial. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. And here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., the Senate has approved legislation to ban imports of Russian uranium used to fuel approximately 12% of the uranium needs for our reactors. On the surface, this legislation is claiming to defund Russia's war machine, but also, on the negative side, it is aiming to revive American uranium production and jumpstart investments in America's nuclear fuel supply chain. The U.S. is ramping up uranium enrichment for a specialized form of fuel called high-assay low-enrichment uranium, or HALEU, which is the fuel most often spoken of in connection with small modular nuclear reactor designs. In Michigan, more than $1 billion could be invested in restarting the Palisades nuclear power plant on Lake Michigan. Holtec, a company associated with decommissioning of nuclear reactors, has been tasked with managing this restart, but has no core competency in managing an active nuclear power plant. Local residents concerned about the embrittlement problems in the 53-year-old reactor and the radioactive waste, which will be stored near the shores of Lake Michigan, are doing what they can to protest and stop this. Radiation and Public Health Project has released a new report showing that the cancer death rate near Palisades nuclear reactor elevated from below to above the U.S. rate after the reactor startup, and cites exposure to cancer-causing radiation routinely released from Palisades as one explanation for this significant change. The cancer death rate in Van Buren County, the site of the Palisades nuclear reactor, moved from 8% below to 14% above the United States average since the reactor began operating, according to this study, a change of 22%. In Japan, the International Atomic Energy Agency has cleared Unit 3 at the Mahama Nuclear Power Plant to run for a total of 60 years, the first time this extension of operation has been granted to a Japanese reactor. At the same time, a metal fitting used on a reactor at the Shika Nuclear Power Plant has fallen off, apparently a delayed effect caused by the magnitude 7.6 earthquake on New Year's Day. And Poland has announced plans to build 6 small modular nuclear reactors by 2043 in the town of Auschwitz. The Vienna Environmental Prosecutor's Office and the organization Cities for Nuclear-Free Europe are protesting. Here is the ICANN update, the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons, direct from their headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland.
Hello, I'm Alistair Burnett from ICANN in Geneva, back with a roundup of news from the campaign for April. Our executive director, Melissa Park, went on a visit to Australia for meetings with the government there about signing the nuclear ban treaty. When he was in opposition, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese committed to signing the treaty. When he came to power a couple of years ago, Mr. Albanese's government changed its vote on the treaty in the United Nations General Assembly from against to abstain. We took this as a positive sign, but since then there's been little movement. Melissa knows the Prime Minister as they used to be colleagues in the Australian Labour Party, and she met him along with the Foreign Minister Penny Wong. They had a constructive meeting where she urged them to sign the treaty as soon as possible, and presented a petition signed by more than 11,000 people across Australia. We know that Australia is under pressure from the United States and France, who both fear the growing popularity and strength of the TPNW. They don't want Mr. Albanese to sign the treaty, and are trying to use Australian concern about the growth of Chinese influence in the region to reinforce that message. But we hope to see Australia join soon. It would show that a country that is a close military ally of the US can join the treaty, as others like New Zealand and the Philippines have already done. In the past few weeks, ICANN has been attending 2 big conferences in Europe on the humanitarian impact of nuclear weapons. The conferences, called Nuke Expo, were held in Belgium and Norway and organised by ICANN partners, Norwegian People's Aid, and the ICRC, along with National Red Cross societies. We were there with our interactive map, which shows when and where nuclear tests have been carried out and the impact they had on people and the environment. If you want to take a look at the map, you can find it at www.nucleartestimpacts.org. Nuclear test impacts is all one word. The team is also hard at work preparing our yearly report on how much each of the nuclear-armed states has spent on their arsenals in the past year. Last year, the total was just under $83 billion, and the US spent more than the other 8 countries combined. To accompany this year's report, which we'll publish in mid-June, we're holding a week of action with our partners to bring this huge waste of money to the public's attention, and to ask them what this money could be spent on instead, to benefit the public good. There are so many problems we need to fix, and this money could really help. If you want to get involved, go to www.icannw.org and click on Take Action. With all the hype around the Oscars and the success of the film Oppenheimer and the TV show Fallout, I've been talking to my colleague Susie Snyder on the line from the Netherlands, where she's based. She's a bit of an aficionado on nuclear weapons in popular culture, so I asked her about the appeal of Oppenheimer. Does it capture the mood of the moment, or is it just a good film?
It's a good movie. It's interesting. It's compelling. You want to follow. You want to see what's happening. You have great actors brought together by a great director telling a story that hasn't been told so many times. And I think that's maybe also kind of what's interesting, because the idea of nuclear weapons is coming back into people's attention a lot more in the last couple of years. And this captures that idea in a way that still gives you a little bit of distance and starts to touch on some themes for which we're still finding different heroes.
It's not the only film or TV program that we've seen over the past year. We've also obviously got the success of this series Fallout, which is based on a game. Do you think that kind of suggests that we're in another moment like we were in the early mid 80s? Films like The Day After and other films that were made about nuclear weapons that some people say helped persuade Ronald Reagan, for example, to go for deep cuts in nuclear weapons in his talks with the Soviet Union.
So we're at this moment where a couple of years ago, we started to see people's attention to nuclear weapons, right? There were these threats and all of a sudden people were questioning, what are they? Who has them? Should I be worried? Do I need to buy iodine tablets for my kids? All of these things. And it takes a few years for a news item, if you will, to trickle into popular culture. It takes a while to produce a TV series. It takes a while to produce a film. It takes a while to get a book into production and into print. And so we see things like Fallout, which is based on a video game that was sparked by people's fear in the 80s of nuclear winter and turned into a massively popular TV show. And we also see Annie Jacobson's book on nuclear war, like what would happen in nuclear war, capturing people's attention. So what happened in the 80s with the Day After is almost an entire population sat together and watched a film together. There were only a handful of channels available on TV, and everybody watched The Day After, or nearly everybody. And so it was impossible to escape. And now we are living in a time where to get anything to break through the massive availability of different TV and movies and streaming services and whatnot, you have to go from multiple angles. People are talking about nuclear weapons, and they're talking about them in a new way. They're talking about them in a way of, oh my gosh, what do they do? They're asking questions. What happens if a nuclear weapon is used? And for ICANN, this is an extremely important time, because ICANN's whole success has been based on the conversation of what happens when nuclear weapons are used. It's the concern about what happens when they're used that got countries together to negotiate the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, because the impact doesn't end at the border. And so all of these people are finally starting to talk about what happens if the bomb gets used, and is it going to be used? And we're here, and we are placed with a solution to that problem. We're here with a treaty that prohibits threats to use the bomb. We're here with a treaty that gives a clear path to verifiable, sustainable disarmament. And now it's just a matter of taking this attention and turning it into action. And I'm excited that there are lots of ways that ICANN and through our partners around the globe, we've been able to mobilize people to pick this up, to take advantage of this. We've got tens of thousands of young people showing up to events that ICANN and its partners are putting on all over the world. Why? Because they see nuclear weapons as a problem, and they know that we have an answer. We have the sequel, if you will, to Oppenheimer, or we have the cure to prevent fallout. And so now we have to rekindle that hope. And that's what looking at things from so many different cultural angles helps us to do. It's why we're also seeing so many artists join up with Artists Against the Bomb, because that's another representation of this transition from fear to hope. And hope combined with action can change the world.
That was Susie Snyder talking to me from the Netherlands with her take on this cultural moment. And the films don't stop there. The director James Cameron, of Titanic and Avatar fame, has recently confirmed he will be making a film based on the book Last Train from Hiroshima. And the director of the Dune movies, Denis Villeneuve, has taken an option to make a movie based on Annie Jacobson's bestseller, Nuclear War, A Scenario. And that's the news from ICANN and the campaign for this month.
That was Alistair Burnett, the head of media for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, and Susie Snyder, ICANN program coordinator. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, each week, the nuclear industry provides us with new nightmares and revelations of old nightmares. But you couldn't tell any of it was happening if all you follow is mainstream media. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat exists, to give a caring, compassionate, and concerned person such as yourself nuclear news that you can count on. We're coming up on the 13th anniversary of Nuclear Hot Seat. That's right, 13 full years of presenting 1 hour of nuclear information every week. As of today, 672 episodes and counting. Nuclear Hot Seat is the world's longest-running program that focuses exclusively on nuclear issues. As both a podcast and, through Pacifica, a broadcast, we have a long history of scooping mainstream media on nuclear stories, giving context and continuity to local, national, and international reports. And we also work behind the scenes, providing introductions and contacts between activists, researchers, and reporters, so that the honest nuclear story gets out far beyond this show. But in order to keep doing this work, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donation, so this is a cue for you to step up and help. How about $5, the same as one would spend here in the U.S. for a nice cup of coffee and a tip to the barista? Or buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee a month with a recurring donation of $5. Or make it much more than $5, one time or on a monthly basis. Every penny goes towards meeting our monthly nut and bringing you the news you've come to respect and admire from this show. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. So help us out. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now and know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Oppenheimer is far from a perfect film, but it certainly is a splashy, high-profile one, winner of the Oscar for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, and many others. It has helped raise awareness of the nuclear weapons that still surround and threaten all life on Earth. But what has been its impact in Japan, the only nation to have been attacked in war by not one but two atomic bombs? To find out, we talked with a genuine expert. Robert Bo Jacobs is an historian of science and technology working on issues related to nuclear technologies. He is a co-founder and lead researcher on the Global Hibakusha Project, conducting fieldwork in more than 20 radiation-affected communities worldwide. He's a professor of history at the Hiroshima Peace Institute and the Graduate School of Peace Studies of Hiroshima City University. He is author of the book Nuclear Bodies, The Global Hibakusha. We spoke on Friday, April 19, 2024. Professor Robert Jacobs, it is always a joy to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's a pleasure to be back, as always.
You are a professor of history at the Hiroshima Peace Institute of Hiroshima City University. What is the institute and what is its work?
The Peace Institute is kind of a broadly defined peace institute, even though we're in Hiroshima. There's about 14 scholars, and each is working on their own field of research and specialization. So there are some people working on, there are political scientists, there are sociologists, historians. Some people are working on institutional things like United Nations or regional peace building organizations between governments. Some are working on Hibakusha studies, memory studies here in Hiroshima. Some people work on war crimes committed during World War II or other issues. So it's modeled originally on European peace institutes like CIPRI. And so we all pursue our own research agenda, but it started as a research institute, But about 8 years ago, we opened a graduate school of peace studies. So we now offer masters and doctorates in peace studies as well. So basically, that's it. It's, you know, we're not intensely focused on Hiroshima. There's actually only a handful of us that work directly on nuclear issues. There's more people working on international governance and international law. And so we're founded by the city of Hiroshima. So I'm a city employee of the city of Hiroshima. Our institute is funded through taxpayer dollars of Hiroshima City citizens. The institute has been here just over 20 years. I think it's maybe 22 years now.
While it is the Hiroshima Institute, does it also include Nagasaki?
Yes. It depends on your research institutes, but we have a very, very close affiliation with RECNA, which is a similar institute at Nagasaki University. So we have a lot of collaboration on events. We have a lot of collaboration on public lectures, speaker series, and most of us have good relationships with a lot of the professors at RECNA. So we realize that we're kind of a similarly construed institute. So there's a lot of cooperation.
The institute in Nagasaki, you call that RECNA. What does that stand for?
RECNA, R-E-C-N-A, is the Research Center for Nuclear Weapons Abolition. So compared to our institute, it is a little more directly focused on nuclear weapons issues and specifically abolition. But there are people there working on a range of issues as well.
What usually happens in Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the anniversaries of the atom bombs come around on August 6th and August 9th?
There are very, very solemn days in both cities. First of all, just as a side note, in August in Japan, and especially in southern Japan, which both Hiroshima and Nagasaki are in, it's incredibly hot and humid. So it's really, really, the weather is something everybody is putting up with. So here in Hiroshima on August 6th, our institute is closed, city offices are closed, but there are thousands of people and increasingly tens of thousands of people who come to the city. The anchor of that day is a commemoration that is held in the Peace Park in Hiroshima. And the prime minister will often speak. There are often visiting dignitaries who speak. There's always people speaking from Hibakusha community, people who are Hibakusha here in Hiroshima. There's always young people, students who are speaking essentially about either nuclear abolition or memory maintenance. It's broadcast on television. So this is sort of the key part of the day. And it starts early. It usually starts by 7:30 in the morning, and it leads up to a minute of silence at 8:15, which is when the nuclear attack on Hiroshima was conducted. So there's a minute of silence at 8:15, and then the ceremony is fairly quickly over at that point. And really, everybody is exhausted from the heat already. Even at that time of the morning, it's brutal here. And so the ceremony is really early, and then the rest of the day, there's a range of events going on all over town. There's a lot of Hibakusha testimony where people who survived the nuclear attack give testimony about their own experiences, about what it was like to endure the attack, about how they or their family or neighborhood recovered. There's often symposia hosted by the city or hosted by various peace groups and various stakeholders in the city, and they may have several speakers talking. The focus here in Hiroshima is very much about nuclear abolition, how to abolish nuclear weapons, and there's also an extremely large amount of energy focused around memory, honoring those that suffered and those that died, remembering them, and finding ways to institutionalize memory of this event and for young people to inherit this memory culture. So that tends to be a real key piece of it. It was really something that was, when I first got to Hiroshima, which was 18 years ago, it was fairly small by contrast. It was really a city event, and there would be peace activists often, anti-nuclear peace activists that came to the city. But increasingly, Hiroshima is, at any given time now, there's thousands of tourists in Hiroshima. There's just more and more people visiting for what is kind of not a large city in Japan. And so now on August 6th, the city is packed solid. And so there's a lot of people, and there's a lot of people going and visiting various August 6th related sites, memorial sites, places connected to it, people going into the Peace Museum, people hearing Hibakusha testimony. And then in the evening, as we head towards sunset There's the other anchor of the day here in Hiroshima, which is the floating lantern ceremony. This takes place alongside the Peace Park in front of the atomic bomb dome, the Genbaku Dome. And people make small lanterns that have prayers or hopes for peace written on them. A lot of this is by students, by young people. And then a candle is placed in it and it's set into the river alongside the Peace Park in front of the A-bomb dome. So there will be hundreds and eventually thousands of floating candle-lit lanterns with messages for peace on the river. And in a sense, it really bookends the morning, because the morning is a fairly formal event where everything is planned and everything is scripted and everything follows a schedule. And then in the evening, the heat is off a little bit. It's still very humid, but it's a little easier to be out, and it's unscripted. There's a ton of kids in line making lanterns, putting them into the river, but people are moving around. There's just looking at the beauty of the floating lanterns floating down the river in front of the dome. That's basically August 6th here. And August 9th in Nagasaki, there's also a memorial ceremony that takes place in the park. Because the Nagasaki nuclear attack happened later in the day, this ceremony takes place a little later in the late morning. And then it's very similar there, that there are symposia, there's hibakusha testimony, and there's a lot of people in the city as well. And so these are really solemn days. But over time, I would say this as somebody who's lived in Japan and in Hiroshima now for a long time, over time, these have become, in Japan, more local ceremonies. Less and less are people in other parts of Japan paying attention or watching on television for the ceremonies than it was, say, 20 or 30 years ago. There's a lot more international attention, but it's become much more regional here in the cities in terms of its memory culture in Japan. So, for example, students that I have here are surprised. I've heard this story frequently, that they will graduate from high school and they will go to college, maybe in Osaka or in Tokyo or someplace else in Japan. And they'll be shocked that many of the people who are their peers in those places don't know which day the attacks happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And they realize that as much as it's heavily received wisdom and culture and memory here in Hiroshima and in Nagasaki, increasingly it's just faded into the general war trauma memory of the Pacific War. And people in the rest of Japan are not necessarily tuning in unless they're peace activists or anti-nuclear activists.
Might there be some intentionality in that as a programmed form of amnesia?
I think that there definitely, it reflects the fact that the national government does not prioritize it, because the national government is fairly pro-military, is enthusiastically under the American nuclear umbrella. And so talk of nuclear abolition, talk of the inhumanity of nuclear weapons runs counter to official policy. So you're not finding the advocacy of any of these issues nationally. And so this, I'm sure, contributes to the fact that it's not really highlighted and promoted throughout the entire country the way that people here in Hiroshima feel like probably is happening, and certainly is what we experience locally.
The film Oppenheimer, which opened last July in 2023, depicts the use of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And the film was released, as I said, not quite a year ago. Yet it was not shown in Japan until March 29th of 2024. And that was 2 weeks after it had already won 7 Oscars, including Best Film and Best Director. How deliberate do you think the delay was in bringing this film out in Japan?
I'm not sure how deliberate it was, but I think that it was just fine with the film's producers, because the entire process of it not being opening in Japan brought more attention to it when it did open outside of Japan. And then when it did open inside Japan, it brought more attention again to the film. So I think that, you know, originally it did not open in Japan, and I'm not sure the degree to which that was based on Japanese domestic energies or whether they did not seek to release it in Japan in terms of the film. But there was both a lot of interest in the film and a lot of animosity that, according to what people here heard, there was no person from Hiroshima or Nagasaki depicted. There was nothing about the actual attacks depicted They were just things that happened in the narration of the movie, but there was no recreation of it. There was nothing that happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and there was also no Japanese people. So there was some resentment about that at the same time that there was interest to see this film, which is about nuclear weapons and about the Manhattan Project. And ultimately, while the film was not specifically about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, really is about the historical basis of what happened before the nuclear attacks in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So people were interested in it and really wanted to see it at the same time that there was resentment. But this was based, of course, on what they were being told by newspaper stories, that there's no representation of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and that that was inappropriate. But people here, for the most part, I happened to be in the U.S. when it was released. And so I saw it in the theater and, you know, pretty much the week that it came out. And so people would ask me about it, knowing that I had seen it. And they were mostly were really interested to see it. And then when it came out here in Japan, a lot of people went out to see it. There was really a push to go see it. But for example, I was interviewed by our local newspaper, the Chugoku Shimbun. I was one of a range of people interviewed responding to the film. What did we think about the film when the film came out? And the reporter, who is a friend of mine I've known for a long time, mentioned that she had contacted the producers for some commentary for a story she was writing and mentioned to them that she was likely to be writing a story that was fairly negative about the movie. And she said they thought that was awesome. And they said, please send us a copy of that. So I think that the fact that it became an issue, oh, it's not released in Japan. Oh, what do the Japanese think? Oh, now it's released in Japan. I think from the point of promoting the film, that just was, they just loved the whole thing.
Expand, if you would, upon some of the responses that people have had to the film. You talked about animosity towards it. What form has there taken, and have there been any protests against it?
I don't know specifically of any protests at all. And Japan is not a protest culture. It's not a common response to when there's not something slightly provocative like the G7. So the response has been really, I found it kind of interesting. In general, people are perplexed at why Hiroshima is not part of the film. You know, why they don't show anything about Hiroshima, why they don't show any of the suffering. And I think that part of that is that the film was promoted really inappropriately from my point of view, because this is not, from my point of view, this is not a film about nuclear weapons. And this is not a film about attacking Hiroshima or Nagasaki. This is a biopic about a hero. And so it's a tiny little sidebar. And so they don't go there because it's messy to mention too overtly that your hero played a role in the murder of hundreds of thousands of people. And so it's really left out. But the film was promoted, and there was a lot of discussion of the film in the press that it was about nuclear weapons, that it was about what does it mean to have nuclear weapons or for us to grapple with nuclear weapons? And I think Christopher Nolan promoted it that way, saying he wanted to make a film about nuclear weapons. And one of his kids asked him about the risk of nuclear warfare. And so there was all of this mystique around the movie that it had something to do with nuclear weapons, but they're really a MacGuffin. It's just a tool, you know, it's just a plot device for us about the hero. There's no way that the film grapples with nuclear weapons at all, not really in any way at all, except as a part of the plot story of the hero. And there's no exploration of what do they mean? What do they do? What is it like in the world to have them? Are they useful? Are they not useful? I mean, there's just nothing about that at all. They're just really a plot device and nothing more. But the movie was promoted as actually somehow having something to do with nuclear weapons. So people here thought that it would. And given that people thought that it would have something to do with nuclear weapons, there was an expectation that the fact that nuclear weapons killed a lot of people would be a part of how that issue was grappled with or brought up. So people were pretty perplexed that it's just not even included at all. So I think the main emotion that I encountered was kind of wonder at why, how could you make this movie and not include that? To get more specific, though, a few more detailed things. One colleague of mine mentioned that her father, when he saw the film, said to her, and she's a historian, said to her, well, do you think that this movie is going to make Putin or Kim Jong-un consider whether or not to have nuclear weapons? And of course, it won't make them think that at all. But this is the kind of way that that hope gets expressed, that somehow this film and raising consciousness about nuclear weapons will be a contributing factor to abolition, to the abolition of nuclear weapons. This is really a key theme here in Hiroshima. And so people want it to play a role in making the inhumanity of nuclear weapons more widely understood and have some potentially some influence on people pushing against nuclear weapon, against having nuclear weapons, and compel those who do control nuclear weapons to reconsider whether they should have nuclear weapons. But I would add one of the most interesting takes that I heard, and this was from one of my students. She said that she thought that it was a good opportunity for Japanese people to realize that Oppenheimer was somebody who actually did a lot of suffering and was not just a demon or a monster. And so I thought, well, there you go. There's an interesting take on how actually for a Japanese audience, the film can move us forward in terms of the way we look at this story, you know, that Oppenheimer was not a monster that came and attacked Japan. He was a tool of a large system, a large military complex system, who played a role and who was discarded by it when he was no longer useful to it.
Does the existence of Oppenheimer have any impact on plans for this year's commemoration of the atomic bomb drops?
That's a good question. I have not heard of anything, but it easily could. It's still fairly early in terms of there being public announcements of stuff going on that's unusual. For example, the content of lectures or symposia. So I don't know. I have not heard anything about it, but I would not be surprised that screenings of it might be included with speakers talking about some of the issues around it. But I don't know specifically that that's planned, but it's certainly the kind of thing that's very likely to be done somewhere here in town.
Has the director, Christopher Nolan, or any of the principals involved with the film actually been to Hiroshima that you know?
Absolutely not. I've not heard of one person with the film having come to Hiroshima. And, you know, I mean, that doesn't mean somebody couldn't just come here, you know, anonymously for a visit, but certainly there's not been any discussion of anybody from the film visiting here at all. I don't know what would be the purpose of that, because it would force them or their spokespeople to deal with some of these questions rather than just let them fester out there and bring more attention to the film. I think much like they avoided dealing with Hiroshima in the film, they're not really interested in dealing with it as an actual place.
I think that's a great observation. What, if any, films would you suggest for people to learn the Japanese perspective on the dropping of the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
In a lot of ways, the urtext for people here in Hiroshima, the film that is essentially the reference point that everybody grew up with and has an opinion about, is the anime made from Hadashi no Gen, Barefoot Gen, which was originally a manga series that was published by a hibakusha, by someone who survived as a child. That's essentially a manga fictionalization of his experience as a child, told in multiple books, and then eventually made into a film. It's the local story, and it's not so well known outside of Japan, but it's really kind of the reference point, and it's played a role, somewhat controversial role, in Hiroshima peace culture locally. In Hiroshima, the teachers union and the Hiroshima school system has taught this history differently than in the rest of Japan. And in many ways, it was seen as being kind of too leftist and too anti-government. And one of the things that was a part for several decades here in Hiroshima of public education was reading Hadashi no Gen, reading Barefoot Gen, reading this manga. And then in the 1990s, the national government pushed and put some pressure on the local school district to change some of the practices here that you could say were a little bit resistant to the national narrative. So for example, it came to be that in many Japanese schools, there would still be some singing of songs that were associated with the imperial period. But here in Hiroshima, we don't want to have war again. We don't want to have nuclear warfare. It's a more anti-military city than a lot of cities in Japan. And so there was protest against this. The flag was not placed prominently in graduation ceremonies, and there was a lot of pushback against what was seen from Tokyo as not following the rules. And so part of how that all ended up falling out was that Hadashi no Gen was removed from the curriculum. So barefoot Gen was removed from the curriculum. It was seen as too controversial. And part of why it's controversial is that the author really grapples with Hiroshima and the nuclear attack in a much more engaged, embodied way than is frequently done here. A lot of the way we talk about the nuclear attack in Hiroshima was that this was an attack on civilians. It was a brutal attack in which all of these people were killed and all of these people were injured and people suffered from radiation, all of which is true, of course. But the way that the story is in Barefoot Gen is really situated more in the reality of the world in which all of this happened. So, for example, there are a lot of characters set in it that are Koreans that are here in Hiroshima because of the Japanese Empire and the Japanese military. There were tens of thousands of Koreans who died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and tens of thousands of Hibakusha who are Korean Hibakusha, and they were here because of empire. They were here because Korea was a part of Japan, was controlled by the Japanese Empire. So that's not a normal part of the commemoration here, but it's a big part of Hadashi no Gen. And so a lot of the things that we might look at as criticisms of the militarism of the Japanese imperial government at the time of World War II, earlier than World War II, but at the time of the nuclear attack, that this didn't just come out of the blue. It came partly because of militarism and imperialism and colonialism. And a lot of the victims suffered because of that. And it deals with things like class differences and the kinds of stuff that is not part of the way the story has been more commemorated. But this was, of course, the lived experience. People had Korean neighbors. People knew, people lived through this. So, you know, there's a way in which the anti-militarist peace culture in Hiroshima embraced this telling of its story, at least locally. But it's not a part of how the city commemorates it or the national government commemorates it. But if you want to understand some of how people here, in terms of film, as you asked, you know, I would say that that's the first thing to go to is find a copy, which you can find with English translation. You can find Barefoot Gen.
If you can send me a link to that film, I will definitely post it at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode. What about the metaphoric treatment of the atom bomb in the 1954 original film Godzilla?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a really key one, and it's multifaceted. For example, I mean, there's multiple things that come in there. The first scene in the movie, in the original movie Godzilla, which, by the way, is the best Godzilla movie of them all, hands down, and not the American version where they spliced Raymond Burr in for a few scenes, which just destroys it. The original one, the very, very first scene is a fishing boat, a tuna fishing boat, and the fishermen are playing some music and singing, and then all of a sudden there's this bright flash, and they're all looking and screaming and yelling, and you hear this attack and see this bubbling in the water, and then you see the boat on fire and sinking. And that's the first scene, and it just doesn't explain it. It just starts there, and then you go to Tokyo. This was a direct reference to the Daigo Fukuyomoro, the Lucky Dragon tuna fishing boat that was exposed to radioactive fallout from the 1954 Bravo hydrogen bomb test that the U.S. conducted at Bikini Atoll. In this test, this massive fallout cloud irradiated and made sick hundreds of Marshallese downwind, and also lots and lots of tuna fishing boats. But the one that was really famous was the Lucky Dragon, the Daigo Fukuyomoru. And this is because it came back to port. The crew was blanketed with fallout for several hours while they were in the fallout cloud from the Bravo test. They were well over 150 miles away. They had no idea that a nuclear explosion had happened. They saw some light in the distance, but they didn't experience the explosion, but they experienced the fallout. And they came to port 2 weeks later, and the entire crew was hospitalized with radiation sickness. One crew member died 6 months later. So here's somebody over 100 miles away from a hydrogen bomb detonation who is killed by it and dies 6 months later because of this detonation over 100 miles away. The reason that this is so important, there were a lot of boats that were experienced the fallout, but the reason that the Lucky Dragon is so important is that This is how news got out about what happened with this fallout cloud and the risk of fallout. The United States had been able to contain, for the most part, all of the damage that was being done by the fallout clouds from the nuclear weapon tests until the Lucky Dragon boat docked outside of Tokyo. And suddenly it was front page news, and outside of the United States, and the United States government couldn't control this narrative. So in my own research, it's hard to find the word fallout in a newspaper story or a magazine article before 1954. That's where the word fallout enters into our lexicon. And from that time on, you see tens of thousands of articles a year with the word fallout throughout the 1950s. So the fact that the Lucky Dragon basically escaped US military press control and landed and had all of these people who were irradiated someplace where there was a free press, health officials went down to Tsukiji Market, the fish market in Tokyo, and found lots of radioactive fish. They found radioactive fish at several markets, several fish markets in Japan. So this was giant news in Japan, and it became global news. So it was directly, I forget the name of the writer of the Godzilla film, but it was after that that he wrote that first scene. So the first scene is really about nuclear testing. And by the way, the first giant bug movie, Them, in the United States, also a reaction to the Bravo test, the news of the Bravo test. But when Godzilla attacks Tokyo, Godzilla has radioactive breath, right? But I would say, too, this is the way that the film is understood here in Japan. A lot of the scenes where Godzilla is storming through Tokyo and burning everything down is also a reference to the firebombings, you know, which is when the United States was essentially burning cities down with napalm, over 70 cities in 1945. The first firebombing of Tokyo, more people were killed than in the nuclear attack on Hiroshima. So some of the graphic images of people being subsumed by fire as Godzilla storming through Tokyo is also about the firebombing history, which is really a powerful chapter of what civilians experienced during 1945 in Japan. But it's also its radioactive fire. So there is a reference to Godzilla as a nuclear weapon. And Susan Sontag talked about how the monsters that were stand-ins for the bomb in these 1950s sci-fi films, they attacked cities just like the weapons did. So this is also a key film, although it's not necessarily associated as much with Hiroshima because it's a fantastic miniature set of Tokyo that Godzilla is stomping on with his big rubber feet.
Anything else that we can go to before we wrap this up?
I think one thing I would just mention is that my institute was founded around the 50th anniversary of the nuclear attack. And it was founded in a way out of the same anxiety that's sort of overwhelming the city now, which is how do we carry this memory forward after the passing of the Hibakusha generation? It's not unlike the anxiety about Holocaust memory. The time frames are the same, similar in terms of losing people who can give direct testimony. How do you keep memory alive without hearing from people who went through something? So part of the idea when my institute was founded was that we would make Hiroshima a city in which peace studies was important and would have a wide impact. And so we'll make this Peace Institute here. There's a lot of programs that are going on here in town around trying to keep memory alive, trying to figure out some way to keep testimony happening without people able to give testimony in person. And this is really one of the things that's a big part of what Hiroshima is grappling with currently, is how to set up mechanisms and institutions in Hiroshima that keep what is called here Hiroshima peace culture, that keep it alive and keep the memory of what happened alive so that Hiroshima can, as is a very big part of its, the intent of the city government and many citizens groups here, Hiroshima can play some role in compelling the abolition of nuclear weapons. So this is very much one of the things that I would mention. And so I think there was some hope that the movie Oppenheimer might contribute to nuclear abolition or the push towards nuclear abolition, but there's certainly nothing in that movie that has anything to do with the ethics of nuclear weapons.
It seems to glorify the process and astonish the younger generation here, which knows nothing about it. They do not know the history. And so this becomes the stand-in for the history, but in a very sanitized way in terms of what it looked like on the ground.
Yeah, it to me, it's just this unbelievably well-funded version for a new generation of the standard American narrative. You know, the standard American narrative of the nuclear attacks being a story about Americans, American scientists, American industry, American politicians, and there's no Japanese people in the American narrative, and there's no Japanese people in this new Hollywood version of the American narrative.
One final thing. What do you generally do when it becomes August 6th in Hiroshima?
Oh, thank you for asking. I actually have a real August 6th practice of my own. The first year I was here, I went down to the ceremony and I took part in the ceremony, but I find it a little bit too controlled. And so the next year, the second year I was here, I went down to the park and I wandered around a bit and I ended up at the A-bomb dome at 8:15. And the A-bomb dome is across the river from the park. It's technically outside of the park. And so it's a little less of a controlled area. So when I was first there, there were people protesting, which is a little bit sort of seen maybe as disrespectful here in Hiroshima on August 6th. And there's also Buddhist monks chanting and drumming. And then at 8:15, at that moment of silence, there's a die-in, you know, where people lay on the ground. Well, for me, when I was there, that second year I was in Hiroshima, you know, I had participated in die-ins all through the Cold War, my childhood in the Cold War. We would go when I was in Chicago and then when I was at the University of Illinois, when they would sound the air raid sirens on Tuesdays when I was where we were, those of us that were anti-military or anti-nuclear, we would gather in the quad at the University of Illinois. And when the sirens would go off, we would all lay down and we would have a die-in. And I participated in multiple other die-ins. So for me, it was like, oh, here's some of my own heritage, my own anti-nuclear heritage that just speaks to how I've processed some of my grief and anxiety around this. And so since then, every single year that I've been here, I go down to the A-bomb dome. It's become a much more contentious place where there's left-wing and right-wing groups that are protesting and often yelling at each other. This is around wanting Japan to militarize, wanting Japan to demilitarize, wanting to get out from the nuclear umbrella, or thinking Japan should develop nuclear weapons. So there's often people with loudspeakers yelling and screaming at each other, which is not normal, or at least not common around here. And after Fukushima, there became increasingly anti-nuclear energy protesting going on and a march. After 8:15, after the minute of silence, there would start to be a march down to the local power company, which had long been planning to build a nuclear power plant not far from here. And so that contentiousness, that reminds me of the way I understood politics in America. So I always go to the dome in the morning on August 6th. And I often, partly because of the contentiousness and also partly because of the sorrow, I sit near this same group of Buddhist monks that are chanting. It really regulates me. It really helps me to feel calm, to be near this chanting and drumming every year. And then I participate in the die-in at 8:15. And invariably, as I'm laying there on the ground in front of the A-bomb dome in the die-in, it just naturally, year after year, I start to realize like how many people are still cowering underneath bombs like that day. And when I first started to do it, it was at the peak of the Iraq War. And I was just thinking about all of the bombing that my country was still conducting. And then every year since then, I just get hit by the fact that there are people somewhere for whom it's not nuclear weapons, but they are enduring aerial bombardment. Civilians again. And so it's partly why I sit by the Buddhist monks, because it helps me to regulate the fact that I'm getting in touch with the fact that this world is still violent. And we do have to commemorate and remember what happened here in Hiroshima and those that suffered and those that died and the inhumanity of nuclear weapons, the ongoing inhumanity of funding and maintaining them and the risk that they pose. But it extends, in my own feeling, it extends into just the people suffering under militarism on any side of any conflict all over the world, that we're just still grappling with that. And then because it's so hot and it's so emotional, I get into the shade somewhere and then come back out and go listen to some lectures or some Hibakusha testimony. But I always go out to the floating lantern ceremony at night because it really is, It really is sort of like a balm on the wound of the day to see all these young people and them being excited and writing down what they think and what they feel, and then the beauty of those lanterns floating on the river. And then I'm just exhausted and I go home.
I would look forward to sharing that kind of commemoration with you should I find myself in Hiroshima on August 6th of any year.
Please come on down.
I will if I can. Beau Jacobs, Professor Robert Jacobs, it's always not only educational and informative, but soul feeding to hear your eloquence on the range of topics that we have discussed through the years. And I think none more than this. So I want to thank you for sharing with us so generously of your thoughts and feelings and observations, and for being our guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Oh, Libby, it's my pleasure. It's wonderful to see you and to be here again, and wonderful to be able to speak with the folks all over the world who listen to this podcast.
Professor Robert Beau Jacobs of the Hiroshima or Hiroshima Peace Institute and the Graduate School of Peace Studies of Hiroshima City University. We will have links up to his website and his book, Nuclear Bodies, on our website, Nuclear Hot Seat number 672. That's also where you will find a link to our interview with him on the book, which is from Nuclear Hot Seat number 632. That's one of my favorite interviews ever from the show. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 7, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, it's the easiest way for you to make certain you never miss an episode. And it's easy to sign up. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. You can't miss the yellow opt-in box. Put in your first name and an email address, and once a week, that's all, you'll get an email with the link to that week's show and a short description of its content. This is our preferred way of you signing up because it helps us with our Google algorithm. The other way, whatever your favorite podcast platform is, go there, sign up, and listen. You can also help us out if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview. Send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate that red button, we really need your help. Anything, anything at all will go towards supporting this show, and we will really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, and throw in some names of the guests, and while you're at it, me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, each U.S. Ohio-class submarine can carry 24 Trident II ballistic missiles. Upon reentry into the atmosphere, each Trident missile splits up into 8 independent reentry vehicles, unleashing up to 192 nuclear weapons in less than 1 minute, each one of which is more powerful than the bombs we dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Don't you think that's something worth protesting? There you go. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Activists, shout out.